Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast, where we take a behind-the-scenes, intimate look at surgery from leaders in the field.
So welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife, everybody. Today we have as a guest Dr. Sani Vasavada, who is the urological director for the Center for Female Urology and Reconstructive Pelvic Surgery here in Cleveland at the Cleveland Clinic within the Glickman Urological Institute. And we also have his wife with us, who is Dr. Parvi Vasavada, who is an assistant professor of radiology at Case Western Reserve School of Medicine, University Hospitals, and Rainbow Babies and Children's Hospital in Cleveland, and has also been recently named the division head of pediatric radiology. Sandy and Parvi, welcome to Behind the Knife.
Thanks. Thanks for having us this evening.
Thanks, Scott.
So today we're going to talk a little bit about something that comes up all too often. It's not a topic that we've broached on BTK, and that's dual physician marriages. And it's something that comes up. We, as you guys know, we have listeners ranging everywhere from medical students all the way up to heads of departments. And one of the things that challenges is, what do you do and how do we make this balance between home life and between our work? And especially when you're dealing in a dual physician marriage or even a dual physician relationship, oftentimes it brings certain challenges, and we get asked about this a lot, so we thought we would cover this particular topic with you tonight. So, Sandy, I'll start out with you, Parvi, I'm going to start with you. How do you establish priorities in this type of relationship that you've had? And did it change through the years as you kind of went through this in terms of travel and training and clinical work and research?
I think that it is having a really good sense of self and what you want to accomplish in your career, as well as being really cognizant of what your spouse wants to accomplish. Sandy had always wanted to be on the fast-track academic trajectory, whereas to me, having a good, strong clinical practice and having a balanced family life was very important. It was really the main priority for myself. And so it was really a careful balance between, you know, melding those two wishes together, so to speak. And, you know, we've really kind of stuck with that, you know, I would have the family as my priority and, you know, and help support his career, and at the same time, you know, do what I could to further my career.
Sandy, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think clearly you things evolve. You finish training, you have sort of your little idealistic world that you believe you want to have for yourself and your spouse, which might be this, you know, little house and a nice job, and then you have kids, and then of course you want to move up the ladder, because most of us were so motivated to get into medicine in the first place that we want to keep on that same trajectory. And then sometimes you just get this little bug that kind of bites you, and then you start to go into, you know, the academic side of things. And I think when you do, that's where sometimes the challenges start to come in, because as you know, there's never a time when the accelerator pedal tends to let up. And so I think that's where, you know, adding the family life to it, your own professional career and development, and then, you know, if you're fortunate enough to get, you know, opportunities, as we both have, you know, on a national and international level, to get asked to do things, that's where, you know, you got to really prioritize things between, you know, yourselves as a couple, you know, adding the family, you know, no one at work or nationally, internationally is going to be very sympathetic to, you know, your kid's soccer game or anything else. So you have to figure a way out between yourselves to balance it out and make it work.
So one of the other things that happens is, you know, deciding during training, in many cases, people get the opportunity to maybe get a residency they want, but it happens to be that they don't have a spot for their significant other, whether that's a spouse or whatever relationship, and we'll just kind of assume that throughout this entire conversation tonight. Do you have any thoughts about advice to give to people regarding, you know, time together versus time apart during training? And did that come up for you guys at all? Or did you know other couples that that did happen to? And what are some lessons learned or some wisdom that you can give there?
I think you have to be really flexible and open-minded. When Sandy and I got engaged, Sandy was finishing a year ahead of me in training, and he had a fellowship spot at UCLA that he actually chose to defer for a year so that he could remain in Cleveland while I finished up my residency. So I think flexibility and understanding for the other's needs is key. It's huge. There's always going to be give and take in a relationship. And I think for couples who are either going through a couple's match or having to, you know, look for, to find a job at a place where their spouse wants to be, but they don't necessarily want to be, it's having some understanding and respect for the other person's needs and being willing to change your own, you know, career path to meet theirs for that moment in time.
As a little bit of background, I know, Sandy, you and probably you mentioned a little bit earlier that maybe the clinical versus the academic side of the house and the little bit of a divergent that each one of you had. Do you think that's necessary? I mean, can you make it work if you're both hardcore? I want to be chairman. I want to be chairman. You're obviously with radiology and with, you know, urology surgery. Was that a player in all of this, that maybe one of you had one goal and the other? And I'm sure we all know couples that maybe it's a little bit different. I know we're going to have a couple of different, both dual surgeon couples on as a portion of this podcast a little bit later, but thoughts regarding that. What if you both are really hardcore and want to climb up the academic ladder?
Yeah, I think if you both are, it just takes even more planning and on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour, week-to-week basis. Because as you know, with the academics, there's so many different things put on you, again, back at work and then as well nationally and internationally, that really make the coordination efforts, and obviously it changes considerably once you have a family, because that, you know, adds responsibilities. That the challenge ends up being, you know, you hate to say that something has to give, but something does have to give. I think most of us would probably be on the same page. We don't want our families to give and families to suffer in any way. So as we, you know, try to march up that ladder, we have to be cognizant of where our priorities are. Certainly we're interested in maintaining work and keeping our reputations as high as they could be, but trying to, you know, pull in other things to kind of help you. And that's where I think even as we both tried to do this and move up, we rely a little bit on our families. We have the fortune of having family nearby. So I have to say that they pitch in and help us a lot, especially when we have travel. And especially when the kids were younger, that really gave us a huge amount of flexibility, a family nearby. And then the other thing is, you know, having close friends, because just the same, there's people who can help you out with a pickup or a drop-off and just little things that you just can't otherwise do because either work gets in the way or, again, you're traveling and that made for other challenges from that standpoint. So I think, you know, having resources is clearly beneficial.
Well, I think the comments you made on flexibility is super important for people to take away from the podcast. And I guess I want to start with, it doesn't sound like you guys did a couples match when you applied to a residency, but can you comment on the couples match versus doing the separate match?
Yeah, so I because I interview residents for our program, and it's a very competitive program, we do have fortune of helping some couples as they go through this. Our situation in urology is a little different because we're an early match, but clearly there's needs because you have one who matches early, and if the other one matches 2 months later, they still want to be in the same city. So a couple things come to mind. One is certainly letting people that you're interviewing with know that you will be looking in a couples match scenario. And I can't tell you how many times I've made a phone call to another department to say, hey, listen, we really like someone, and is there a prospect for his or her spouse or spouse-to-be in the context of this couples match, because I think we're going to, you know, rank this person high. And then, you know, they need to kind of know that in the sense that, you know, at least they're looked upon favorably without violating any rules in a match, obviously. So I think that's one thing. So if you're looking to do that, you need to kind of get that out in the open, that this is an area of interest. And then your significant other is also looking at a similar program opportunity in the same, be it in the same hospital or perhaps in the same city or nearby cities. So you know, I think that's something you need to make sure it's readily corresponded with and communicated.
Sydney, I want to ask you to expand on one of the statements you just made, and as much honesty as you can give to someone like this. Have you ever ran into a situation where you really like, you know, putting on your program director kind of hat, that you really liked the one candidate, but you couldn't stand the other one, and nobody liked? Have you ran into that situation? Is there anything that you kind of learn walking away from that? Are you honest with the person in that situation and say, listen, we really want you, but we can't do it for your significant other?
Yeah, I can't remember a scenario recently. Again, we have such a competitive residency to get into that, you know, every scenario has probably been played out that I just don't recall. But definitely, you know, it's not always going to work out. And when you do make that phone call, and that has been the scenario where I may make a phone call and say, listen, we got a superstar here. And they'll say, like, you know, who's the significant other? And I'll mention the name, like, okay, well, let me see what we can do. But, you know, you can already tell on the phone that they're not really as, you know, strong a candidate, perhaps, as the one you'd be looking at. And then, obviously, you know, that's just all in advance of the match. So you have to take that into consideration when you're making your rank lists, and our program directors, as they do that, have to add those types of things in. You know, that being said, we live in a city where there's a number of training programs and opportunities for most residencies. So they'll never be, or at least I should say never, they should seldom be situations where they may not be able to match still within the same city or same general region. So even if perhaps the one candidate we like did match with us, and maybe their spouse or significant other might be at a nearby hospital or very, very nearby city that they could perhaps develop a, you know, somewhat of a commuting situation from. You know, we have that fortune where we all are here in Cleveland with some top-notch institutions in the city and, you know, nearby cities as well, where there's training opportunities for everyone.
That was great. And to ask a very personal question, and maybe you can just give us the advice that you give to residents that are married to other doctors, but how do you approach family planning and when to have kids in residency and post-residency, and how did you guys go about that?
I'm really honest. I usually give them my own, you know, personal situation as an example as to what worked for me. They are all in different situations. But, you know, it's hard having kids in residency. You have to know what resources you have available to you, what support you have. You know, I think for a lot of women today too, they want to be able to do it all. They want to be able to balance careers and families. And, you know, the situation, a lot of times they ask me, like, what did we do for childcare? What support did we have? How did we adjust our jobs? And, you know, for us, it was really about, you know, careful planning and, you know, knowing when to utilize help and to bring in nannies or, you know, to fly family in to help us out. So.
And how does it, and I guess from both your perspectives in dealing with residents, are training programs generally pretty flexible in allowing residents to take maternity or paternity leave and helping them adjust to this, obviously, big life change?
You know, in radiology, obviously, when a female resident is pregnant, she can't do fluoroscopy. We prefer that they don't, and we're very understanding about that. And, you know, we've been really great about giving our female residents as much time as they need. Male residents get paternity leave for, you know, a couple of weeks or whatever time that they need to adjust to their new family dynamic. And I've found, at least really recently, that people are so supportive of the changing needs of residents in training and fellows in training.
Yeah, I think there's a complete change in the times compared to when we trained, where it was really like it was an uncommon situation where people were having kids during residency. And now, I mean, I know we have 30 residents, and I think as of the spring, we'll have 14 out of 30 of the residents will have children, which back when I trained, I think there was one or two of the residents who had children. So it's a complete change in the dynamic, and I think it's partly to what Parvi said, that I think there's other resources now, given to residents with paternity leave and maternity leave. Obviously, there's on-site daycares, which are more and more common. I mean, there's so many other scenarios that really make it easier to do that I think for us it would have almost been impossible back in the day in training for us 15 years ago to have been able to have children easily. And again, the times have changed, so I think it's a lot more doable now than it was before.
So one of the things that this particular podcast is really kind of the undertones of it is about balance. And kind of take us through in terms of how this balancing of your home and your life outside of work prior to having kids, and then how that's evolved until the point where you both are now in leadership positions. And do you look at dual position dual position couples, knowing what you've gone through in these different aspects of life now when you're in these leadership positions and able to impart advice on them? Or how is that balance kind of carried all the way through, and how do you go about prioritizing things again?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I think it's in summary, it's very hard, and I think it's the hardest thing. In fact, I was telling my daughters when I was driving to school this morning, I said, we're doing this podcast, and one of the things is really about achieving work-life balance. And my one daughter says, "Well, Dad, you guys don't do that." So I don't know what you're going to say to that. And I think, the sign of it is really that it evolves. Clearly it changes based on things that you have on your plate. When we first met in residency, you're still, having a good time because, you don't have as many other responsibilities. When you weren't on call, life wasn't too bad unless you had to study for board exams and things. And then as we moved into fellowships, kind of the same thing. We were just, kind of getting solidifying our relationships early on. But then as we took our first jobs, our first year we didn't have any children. And I remember we were in Philadelphia and my wife and I would meet up on Friday evenings because we worked at the same hospital on Fridays, that, every evening we could go out to dinner and then we can go to shows. If we decided we want to go up to New York City, we'd do that. And so there were so many easy things to do. And then when we had my son, all of a sudden, I was like, "Oh my God! Who's going to pick him up after daycare?" And we have to get out. And 5 o'clock, all of a sudden, became this witching hour that we had to get out by. And so then the whole evening and fun time kind of changed. And then it was prioritizing what we do as a family now that really made it harder. And then as we talked about with starting to move in the academic tracks, adding layers of responsibility, and clearly call and other clinical responsibilities weren't going to give up. So then it was just a matter of prioritizing and trying to do things like that are fun. Otherwise, you end up really getting to be probably a crabby person. So we try to plan some good trips, and I think using the opportunities that the jobs do afford us, which somewhat is monetary, to be able to use that to our advantage, to at least use that for your free time and have fun and have a good time as a family, which again, during the regular day-to-day, week-to-week, can be a bit of a grind. But I think that's where we started to use our vacation time or even travel or meeting time, if we can get a couple days tagged on the end of that, to really make it a little bit more fun. As you kind of go through the academic track, then the more and more coordination needs to be had. There's no way you can do this without disrupting your day-to-day family life, because one person's out, someone's got a dinner meeting, someone's got a recruitment dinner, You know, early morning meetings at 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock in the morning. And so with all that, let alone call, I've been on call all week and going in to operate at, you know, 2, 3, 4 in the morning, which is just, if she was on call at the same time, it really makes it really challenging. So you gotta, you know, someone's gotta take the kids to school or something has to be, you know, had to help you. And again, that's just a coordination thing that you have to work out between the two of you.
Scott, I think the other thing that's been really beneficial to both of us is just having great people that we work with. They're instrumental sometimes in making sure that the work-life balance is achieved. You know, if one of us has to be somewhere for a child or for an event, and, you know, I've been at least fortunate, and I think Sandy has too, to have partners who sometimes understand and say, I can cover for you so that you can get out and do what you need to do. Because I think if you work with a great group of people, they realize that we're all kind of in the same boat together. We all have places we need to be and responsibility to things outside of the hospital. And they're willing to cover to help you so that, you know, it doesn't become all about work.
I guess continuing on with the, you know, balancing home and life, and is how much do you bring your work home? You know, are you curbside and consulting each other? Are you, you know, you're at rival institutions? Do you talk gossip about each of the institutions or what goes on at work?
Oh, we laugh. We say we're a mixed marriage because he works for the clinic and I work for UH.
Uh-huh.
It's actually a pretty good, you know, it's like a running joke at our house.
But we try not to bring too much work.
No, go ahead, Danny. So, I know it happens, but how much do you, I mean, it does have its advantages. And tell us about those dinner parties that you have when you have the non-medicine person and everybody's talking medicine. How do you guys get around that?
Well, we usually serve more wine and then all of a sudden the medicine talk stops. So. But I think that is a challenge when, you know, this as being in part of medicine, it is so much all-consuming. And I can't speak for people in other walks of life as to how much their kind of job is sort of consuming to their, you know, day in and day out life. But, you know, obviously with two physicians in a marriage like this, you do tend to talk probably a little bit more shop. And again, the challenges that go with the work-life balance and things that we talked about. But I think, you know, you know that you have a distinct life outside of medicine. And perhaps some of the people we both respect the most probably are those who really don't talk much about, you know, medicine. And these are physicians and people that we respect. So I think that's where it's nice to really be able to carve out the non-medical talk. It's enjoyable and very easy to talk medicine and talk shop, but just the same, getting to know, and I think a lot of our friends anymore, you know, everyone isn't in medicine, so it's really kind of enjoyable when we have a chance to talk you know, outside of our own little domain.
If you could just give us, you know, the bird's eye view of the best and worst parts of being a dual physician marriage.
I can give you the worst part. As being the spouse who has the more flexible schedule and the better hours. Sometimes you actually, you know, as much as you support your husband and you, or your wife, and you support their career, sometimes it's hard not to be a little resentful that, you know, the person who is busier isn't available for everything, and that you're kind of left on the front line with, you know, work, the house, the kids, because the other person is, you know, traveling or lecturing or late in the OR. And, you know, as much as you understand what they're doing and you support their career, it's just, I think sometimes human nature takes over and you're like, gosh, I really wish I had some extra help here. So, you know, sometimes the hours can be really long, and I think that's really tough. And, you know, when you're coming home and you've worked hard and, you know, you have to deal with homework and dinner and crazy kids, it's hard not to be a little bit upset because the other person isn't home, because they're doing something, you know, equally important, and they're busy too. So I think that's really the worst part, is sometimes being left on your own and on the front line.
Definitely.
I mean, I think to even add to that a little bit, you know, not to hit bad parts before good parts, because hopefully your listeners don't really think it's all bad. But I think, you know, you do suffer a little bit on the fatigue side. I mean, I know when both of us, and it doesn't happen often, where both of us happen to be on call and one's pager goes off, and because she does, you know, pediatric radiology, you know, you have to kind of put on a little different hat, because if she has to go in, and I can overhear the conversation, I can almost always, almost with 100%, tell if that study is going to be positive or negative simply based on the conversation she's having. But when she has to go in, it's simply because, you know, it's someone else's child, and we would want the same sort of courtesy and would expect that someone would come in the same context. So you have to be understanding and respectful of that. You know, that she's going to have to get up. But then the fatigue factor starts to settle in, because, you know, then you're up all night and, you know, both of you are tired because someone else has to get up early and manage the other things that go on, or if you have a full day, or maybe both of you get called in. So that's going to make a big difference right there. So the call situations can make it. And then coordinating all that with your schedules. So it really doesn't allow for as much spontaneity as you'd like in your schedule, you know, to say, hey, let's go on a trip this weekend. Oh, no, I can't. I'm on call. Or I've got a meeting that I have to go to. And so those types of things, when they start to come up, it does probably have some effect on your day-to-day, you know, existence, I'd say.
I think the flip side of it is, though, that you always have someone there who gets it, and who gets what you're going through, and understands that what, you know, being on call for 24 hours and then having to go into work and operate and put on your game face and, you know, perform your very best does to you. Like, I think that support, like when I've had a really bad day at work and then I've had to take call and I've been up all night, like Sandy gets it, and he would be the first person to say, you know, what can I do to make it easier for you, because I've been in that situation myself. And that's huge, to not have to explain that, you know, what a bad day is for you.
That's great. And I have a question, more of a practical question. You know, my wife and I, we're busy, but we're not nearly as busy as you all are, and you have kids. And how do you synchronize your schedules from just a logistic standpoint? Do your secretaries email each other? And I mean, I just can't even imagine.
We're not that slick, and nor are we that slick technologically to, you know, I know a lot of people do Google calendars and things, and I think ours is somewhere in between all that, and we're not, you know, technologically averse. It's just, it's just kind of one more thing to have to manage. I think it's just kind of on a week-to-week basis, or a couple weeks, that we really try to coordinate schedules. I think our secretaries do know our schedules sometimes better than we do. I do know when my wife has something that I have to be at, she doesn't even bother talking to me about it. She has my secretary block me out for a day, and, you know, it'll be on my calendar somewhere. And so she'll sometimes go right over my head and make sure that I'm blocked out for a day by coordinating things that way.
I think one person has to be, at least one person has to be incredibly organized in the relationship. So, I mean, we may coordinate 2 to 3 weeks every couple of weeks, but I'm always aware of what's going on months in advance so that I can make sure that Sandy's where he needs to be, that the kids are where they need to be. I think organization is the key in a dual couple marriage, to make sure that everything works and everyone gets where they need to be and nothing falls through the cracks.
Harvey, I love how you just said at least one person needs to be organized, and I'm always making sure that Sandy is where he needs to be. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah, no, I like that.
Obviously, the role of the traditional student has gone away a little bit. In many cases, people are married now more in medical school. I can remember when, you know, I started medical school in 1998, and we had maybe one or two married people, and that's just that's not the route today. So what advice do you have for married, I guess this goes to, you know, dual position, but even, you know, people are busy. They have both couples, the traditional household, as one would see in Americana, doesn't really happen. But starting all over again at separate stages, medical school and having choosing medical school, and all of a sudden residency, and then all of a sudden now you're looking at full-time jobs, and did this bringing each other along, bringing families into the situation, and what jobs you can get, how did that change over time from those different major points in your medical careers?
Yeah, I think, even just historically, we've seen that change, like you mentioned, where it probably wasn't happening as often in the past. Now it seems like I see it much more often, where people either are getting married earlier in medical school, and it's wonderful. I think just society affords us a lot more abilities to coordinate things now than ever before. And it's not to say spitefully back in the day that we just didn't have those opportunities, but in the 90s, we really didn't have as many resources for spouses and things. And now with other ways that there's just a lot more resources where people can lean on each other and sort of different groups where they support each other. You know, some of our training programs now are bigger and bigger than ever before. And so you've got other people in the same boat. Whereas prior to that, in previous generations with this training, it seemed like you're almost always all alone, or there was a program where you had one or two residents instead of per year instead of more. And as these programs have gotten bigger, again, there's more people you can kind of lean on to help. I think just the camaraderie that happens within residencies, and it's a key thing to look for. I think when we even tell prospective applicants looking at our program, I said, listen, you've got 29 or 30 other instant friends that you have right when you sign up in our program. I said, it's huge. And even in our fellowship training programs, you've always got, you know, we've got two people a year. So with that, I mean, to have the resources and the friendships you develop immediately, that's something that really is very, very beneficial. Then when you're alone going to a new town, you've never been there, you just happen to get the match list and this is where you're going, that makes a difference now than ever before. And so that's where I think it's kind of changed over the years.
Dr. Vasavada, Sandy Vasavada, one question I have for you is, I've seen your resume and it's incredible. And the one question, how do you decide, do you work on papers when you come home? Do you wait till the kids go to bed and then work on papers? How do you fit that kind of academic stuff in, or do you just finish it all at work? How does that work for you?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I think you try not to bring too much stuff home, because anyone who's got kids, let alone when you had little kids, you realize you got absolutely nothing done at home. So you somehow, you know, figure out, I think, quite honestly, most of my productive time is when I travel. And I sometimes get a little spiteful about it, because once the little light goes off that you can turn on your electronics, you know, other people turn their headphones on and listen to the music or get their little e-reader out. Whereas I've got my laptop out and I am either doing a journal review, I'm writing something, updating a book chapter, maybe doing my next lecture that I'm traveling to a meeting for. So I'm feeling like I'm always working. And obviously when I look to, you know, a transcontinental flight, and I look almost, happy, because it's 5 hours of work I can get done, and God forbid there's not an outlet or I don't have a full battery charge. Because that's lost time for doing those types of things that we do. Otherwise, it's early morning hours. Is another opportunity in between operating cases for me. Are the only other times I really tend to do most of it. But I've been really trying to get away from doing stuff at home, namely because it just tends not to be as productive as I would like it to be, because I'd rather spend it probably with the family.
I guess the last question to kind of round everything out there is, you know, you already talked about flexibility as being advice to dual physician marriages. And is there anything else you guys would be willing to share, your final advice for everybody?
I think have a sense of humor.
That's good.
<man. laughs> A sense of humor and a healthy dose of understanding.
Yeah, I think you definitely have to do that. You have to be more, because if life's serious, our jobs are serious, you know, and we're being scrutinized more now than ever before. It's challenging, and then to balance all this out makes it even harder. I think, personally, you know, spending some of your hard-earned money on some of the conveniences that life affords us now with you know, carrying out or, you know, nannies, other resources that, you know, money can buy anything. But I think some of those little extensions can make a difference in your day-to-day life, because the nanny, for instance, is, you know, when we've had nannies when the kids were a little younger, they were part of our family, but boy, I mean, we couldn't survive without them. And I think that was a huge difference. We've had some friends and colleagues who've had some, you know, personal chef services who came in at different points in time, and it sounded, you know, very extravagant on one hand. At the same time, when you realize how much you spend when you get, you know, groceries and get carry out and everything else, they realize that they had, you know, healthier, better food cooked in their house for them routinely, and they never had to worry about that. And so then that was another advantage. So again, kind of taking, you know, some of your money, using that for some of these conveniences, it probably does go a lot longer away than you really believe it would, you know, on a day-to-day basis, when it looks like it's just, you know, money in, money out.
Well, that was fantastic advice, and we really appreciate you guys joining us and getting personal and telling us really what it is like. And what we round out each podcast with is the final five. These are five questions we ask our guests to get to know them a little bit better. And so you guys, we've never had a husband and wife couple on the final five, so you guys can just tag team this as you feel fit. Number one, what music is on your, or first of all, do you listen to music in the operating room or radiology suite? And if so, what type of music?
Well, I can tell that one easy, because the answer is yes. I definitely listen to music, and I tend to listen to classic rock. For people who know me, I'm a huge Rush fan, and so Geddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and Neil Peart are definitely in the background in most of my cases.
And in radiology, if we have any music playing at all, it's Soft Little Lullabies or something kids would love.
Just to put you even further to sleep in the darkness. I like it. Number two, tell us about any hobbies, talents, interests that you might have outside of the hospital.
Yeah, I've been an avid wine collector for almost two decades now. It's something I kind of actually tripped on when I was at a meeting in San Francisco, of all places, and someone kind of took me under his wing there, and you know, really kind of got the bug in me, and I really would have been a huge fan of wine ever since. So it's just sort of our thing, kind of, you know, working with other groups and people in town to kind of cultivate my interest even more. And it's really just been a lot of fun to continue to collect wine. And when I travel, we'll pick up different wines or go to vineyards in different places of the world to really get to know their region. So it's been fun.
And for any listeners out there who ever run into Sandy in real life, watch out for the big pour if you have something to do. You bring up a giant glass. Watch out for that one. Harvey, what about you?
You know what? I love to read. I love to read anything that can take me away from medicine just for pleasure. It's a great way to decompress from, you know, a busy day. And it's something I do for myself. So I'll read anything that doesn't have to do with medicine in my free time.
Perfect. Question number three, is there a favorite trip or vacation you guys taken maybe as a family? This is recently, I guess. Yeah.
We've done a lot of trips and had the fortune of doing that. I think, you know, our favorite trips, I don't know if the kids always felt it was their favorites, but they've been to parts of Europe, I think. You know, just experience different cultures and, you know, obviously the food there, you can't get, seems to be a bad meal anywhere in Europe. And so we've always enjoyed going there. But again, we've had the opportunities to take them to India and other parts of the world, and certainly in the States. So I think we've really enjoyed that and hopefully continue to enjoy that over the coming years.
Okay. Number four, and I'm going to add a extra part to this question. What would you be doing if you're not in medicine? And the second part of the question is of all your children, how many of them at this point in time say they want to be doctors?
Parv, I'll let you answer that one.
If I wasn't in medicine, gosh, you know what? Despite everything, I love my job. So I guess if I wasn't working in medicine, maybe I would be on a beach on the French Riviera drinking Sandy's wine. So I think that's what I would be doing. I think out of all of my kids, maybe one or two would be going into medicine at this point in time.
All right. The fifth question, our final one, we can just answer separately, would be, if you go back in time and see yourself on the first day of your internship, what advice would you give yourself?
Wow. it's not too late to quit. No, I think, you know, it's surrounding yourself around good people. I had the fortune of having some fantastic friends in residency, and as they kind of went through the training program with me, and you lean on them, they're some of my best friends still. They were in my wedding, I was in their weddings, and you know, it really made what can otherwise be a challenging time, you know, between medical school and residency and otherwise and training, it's a hard time, and to have friends and close friends that you can really rely on and just have a good time with really made, you know, for me, 6 years fly by. And I still look at that back very, very fondly for me.
I think mine would be something similar. I think I would tell myself to actually to enjoy the ride, to enjoy it all, the good, the bad, to kind of cherish every moment of it because you never get that time back. And there is an importance to every stage of training. You know, there's an excitement to that first job. There's just so many wonderful moments that we kind of take for granted and don't appreciate. And so I would just say, you know, enjoy it all.
Well, Deckers, Vasavada, we thank you so much for joining us on Behind the Knife and truly giving us a behind-the-scenes look at what is it like to be a dual-position couple, and having gotten the chance to know you both personally, you've done it very well, and the proof is in the pudding, and then the wonderful relationship and wonderful children that you have, and we just really thank you for sharing some of the more intimate details, and we look forward to having you back on Behind the Knife.
Great, and thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Until next time, dominate the day.